Welcome, investors, to the Absolute Return Podcast, your source for stock market analysis, global macro musings, and hedge fund investment strategies. Your hosts, Julian Klimochko and Michael Kesslering, aim to bring you the knowledge and analysis you need to become a more intelligent and wealthier investor. This episode is brought to you by Accelerate Financial Technologies. Accelerate, because performance matters. Find out more at accelerateshares.com.
Welcome, investors, to the Absolute Return Podcast. I'm your host, Julian Klimochko.
And I'm Mike Kessler.
Today, we have a special guest on the podcast. That's Tyler Stewart, who's a managing director and co-founder of one of the largest cannabis private equity firms in the business. That is Green Acre Capital. He provides some great insights on the cannabis and investing business. So anyone trades stocks in the space, invests in the cannabis space, this is a must-listen episode. Before we get into it, just want to disclose that Tyler is an advisor and investor in Accelerate, and he provides some super unique insights on where this cannabis industry is going. So enjoy the show. Cheers. All right, we're live with Tyler Stewart, founder and managing director of Green Acre Capital, which is a leading cannabis private equity investment firm. Welcome to the Absolute Return Podcast, Tyler. How are you doing today?
Good. Thank you for having me.
Yeah. Glad to have you on the podcast. To start out, why don't we just get a bit about your background? Tell listeners how you got into the cannabis investing space.
Sure. Yeah. So I come from the investment banking side of the business. Most of my career was spent on what we call the sell side in different roles. Most of it with a boutique energy investment bank here in Calgary called First Energy. And I wrapped up that part of my career in 2015, 2016, was looking for a bit of a change, wanted to move on to what we call the buy side of the business, whether it be private equity or venture capital. And at that time, there was a lot of discussion around cannabis becoming legal as Trudeau got into power. And so I thought, you know what, here could be a potentially interesting opportunity that I didn't think a lot of people were talking about. I think there was enough that made it interesting, but not too many that made it crowded at that time. And so I spent most of 2016 just doing my homework and research on the industry, mostly in the U.S., because if you recall, there was already some states that had legalized back in 2014. So we could already see how that recreational market was unfolding. So I was on a plane in a lot of different directions, going to conferences and trade shows and meeting with different companies and just trying to get the knowledge base up. And form a thesis and figure out what the best opportunity would be for me at that time. And so I came together with a few partners who are now my partners at Green Acre, and we launched our business, which is a venture capital fund, in January of 2017, after spending close to a year studying the market and figuring out what that thesis might look like.
So you've followed the cannabis industry for a long time now, and you've been investing for a number of years. When you set up Green Acre, what was your initial approach to cannabis investing, and how has that evolved over time?
Yeah, you bet. So when we set it up, we thought, okay, you know, there's already a little bit of hype in some of these names. You know, this is going into mid to late 2016. And stocks had been moving already. The early movers had been, at least. And so we thought, okay, well, we probably don't need to go set up a hedge fund and invest in publicly traded companies with real high volatility. We thought we could add more value digging around in the corners and looking at sectors that were underfollowed. So our initial thesis in 16-17 was we were going to be early stage venture capital investors in ancillary cannabis businesses. So the way we looked at ancillary was anything that's not a pure play grower. So at the time, all of our licensed producers were cultivators, and they were just providing flower and some oil to the medical and then soon to be recreational market. And we thought, okay, there's a whole other segments or multiple segments of infrastructure type investments that we could make. And we could find a lot of interesting deals. And most of the time we had a little bit more leverage to strike better terms in some of these deals where the crowds weren't investing in yet. So some of our early investments that worked out well for us, one was a brand play called Tokyo Smoke. Another was a testing lab called Anandia. And we still got the benefit of a robust public market on the exit of these businesses, but we weren't necessarily investing in those licensed producers. So that was really the premise initially. It was to be active investors, to take a venture cap or private equity type of approach where we were making anywhere up to like a 5 to 7 year investment, being active on the board or in strategic advisory roles. In some cases, we even started businesses where we saw a gap in the market. We saw something that was working well in a established U.S. state, but we didn't see it up here, and nor did we see people launching those businesses. So we've actually created our own businesses where we acted as interim CEO and then brought in staff and did most of the capital raising. So a fairly active approach to the companies that we're investing in. We generally wouldn't invest in anything unless we've spent a lot of time around the people and seen the assets and toured the facilities and gotten comfort with the individuals and their facilities.
Sounds like a lot of due diligence. Mike, go ahead.
So Tyler, when you look at your previous experience in an energy-focused investment bank, where do you see some of the synergies between energy investing and cannabis investing now?
Yeah, you know, I think the two industries are similar in that they're both capital intensive industry. And so, you know, the energy market is notorious for needing to raise a lot of funds. And the bulk of cannabis businesses are in cultivation here in Canada, and that's expensive. You know, it's expensive and time consuming to build out your facility. Without knowing you're even going to be licensed, you need to raise tens of millions of dollars, and it would take you 2 to 3 years before you're even licensed. And then once you're up and running, you lose one crop, and that's a huge drain on your cash flow. So you notice that these cannabis companies, when the markets were open for them back in 17 and the first part of 18, they were raising crazy amounts of money. You know, they might have been it might have been the most active industry for a period of time for these investment bankers raising money. So I think, you know, the closest parallel to energy would be the amount of cash that's required or capital that's required to fund these operations. And you know, it's funny, you'd see a lot of the same investors in small cap energy just jumping around to other hot industries. And so we saw a lot of those same names playing the public cannabis companies in the early days as well. So high tolerance for risk obviously was required for those investors.
Yeah, there was a lot of hot money and a lot of speculation a number of years ago as those businesses were getting formed. What I find fascinating is not only is your firm active in the investments you make, but you also indicated that you're involved in starting and launching cannabis businesses. Can you give some examples of companies you've helped incubate? Could just be from a broad general sense.
Yeah. I think the best example is a project that I've been working on out on Vancouver Island for a couple of years now. This plays into one of our thesis, which is we always felt that the large licensed producer is going to be the Budweiser analogy. And then what we need to see is a lot of craft plays. So craft beer became a real thing in the last couple of decades. And we always saw that these large LPs were set up with, you know, great entrepreneurs or brokers or bankers or lawyers, but they weren't really set up with a view to grow the highest quality cannabis and create a brand that was really based on quality, which I use the craft beer analogy because a lot of people have gone away from that mass produced beer into a craft beer because they think it's a better tasting product. And so we saw cannabis was going to play out like alcohol, say, or any other food or consumer packaged good. And we didn't see the attention to quality from the beginning with these LPs. You know, we had hundreds or more companies come through the boardroom, and they'd be describing their teams and their approach to the business. And there was no commentary on who that master grower would be. So think of it as, you know, would you launch a beer label without a brewmaster? Would you launch a wine label without a winemaker? There's no way you would, because it all starts there, right? And so what we thought was going to happen is we'd have hundreds of these LPs come out, and they'd all be competing on size and scale, and eventually a lot of them would have to fail because everyone can't be Budweiser. And so what we did see was that attention to the craft and to the quality being led by people that already had decades worth of experience growing this plant. And a lot of those people were having problems getting into the market. They're not your typical entrepreneurs that do well in highly regulated environments. You know, the black market in cannabis, it attracts a lot of different characters now. The catch 22 is that they've got a lot of the expertise, and that takes a long time to develop. You know, it's not just flipping a switch and expecting that you can grow a great product overnight. So to address that perceived gap, what we did is we said, okay, how can we work with a whole bunch of these black market growers that want to come to light and want to get a small facility license and then need help doing that? And so we put in, we started a company, and essentially what it is, it's like a growing collective. And so we're helping through our consultants get these growers on Vancouver Island all licensed. And we're setting up another business, which is going to be a processor. And essentially that processor is where we're going to try to create value. And we're going to have exclusive offtake arrangements with our army of growers on the island to take all that high quality flower in and then get it to market, whether it goes in jars as dried flower or pre-rolls or a certain type of extraction into a vape pen or an edible. So we thought that was a way to play the craft market at scale. Because I think that, you know, there's two ways to win. You could win by size and economies of scale, and you can be that Budweiser, or you can be that great craft brand. But you just need to still be able to scale that craft brand. So this was our solution. So we own 70% of the business. I still act as CEO. And we're getting licensed and getting built out, and then we'll eventually pass it over to full-time staff to run.
Now, there's a lot of different areas in the cannabis value chain, many of which you've already mentioned, whether it be licensed producers, retail, processing, distribution, or perhaps even ancillary businesses such as software and things of that nature. Now, as a firm, do you tend to diversify across the value chain, or do you find certain areas more compelling than others at this moment?
Yeah, we try within the portfolio. We have two funds now, and within each fund, we've tried to diversify into multiple segments of the value chain. So we do have exposure, despite what I had said about the LPs. We still do have some cultivation exposure in Canada as well as the U.S. We've got a lot of retail exposure. Particularly given our last deal was a fairly large deal into a public retailer up here in Canada. So we're pretty heavy in Fund 2 on retail. We feel like there's a disconnect right now, and that the market is assigning a disproportionate amount of the value to the growers in Canada. And when we look at the U.S. market, for example, these MSOs are vertically integrated, so they could grow, distribute, process, manufacture, and retail. And so you have more assigned value to each side of or each part of their operation. And so we didn't see that in retail. We saw these things trading at 0.5 to 0.6 times sales, which is extremely low. When we look at the U.S., it was more like 1 to 2 times. And we didn't see the pubcos getting the credit for the amount of revenues that they're generating now. So retail to us looks really good right now. And so we've built out a really strong retail portfolio. We have pure play operators in BC, in Alberta, in Saskatchewan, in Ontario. And then we've just made a large deal in one that has probably the largest footprint in the country. That one's called Fire and Flower. We're also kind of circling back on some of these distressed LPs. Some of these might start to look good if they're in the right neighborhood, if we can get the right operating team in there. We just need to figure out what our secret sauce is and why we can do this better versus others that have kind of failed. So we're starting to have more discussions internally, at least, about some distressed pubcos or distressed LPs. We still like brands. We think brands win in almost every other consumer segment out there, whether it be alcohol, whether it be food, whether it be cars, clothing, brands win. And our first investment in Tokyo Smoke taught us that. So we're still looking to build out great brands or support great brands. I talked about the craft market. I still think it's underrepresented. So we want to have good exposure there. You know, the other large question that we're asking right now is what happens if the U.S., or when the U.S. decides to federally legalize cannabis. And in times like this, with COVID and a lot of jobs lost and contraction in economies, I think governments will be looking closer at all sources of revenue. And so it's natural to think that cannabis has a better chance of going federally legal in the U.S. Post COVID. So that's one of the internal discussions now as well is how do we play that? How do we capture value in that scenario where all eyes are on the U.S. legalizing?
Yeah, this market is developing so quickly, and you guys have an interesting viewpoint because you're largely focused in the private markets. However, you do delve into the public market as well on occasion. So how do you see the differences in these various markets, private versus public? And are you seeing like any major differences in valuations or opportunity set?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. Usually you always see a discount on the private companies. You know, they trade at a discount to the publics for a reason. So you look at your public market comps and then you say, okay, I'm a private. So what's my discount? Is it 10? Is it 20? Is it 30%? And, you know, the whole cannabis sector started pulling back in fall of 18 when we legalized. So right around October of, I think it was October 18th that we legalized the market, you could just see the market roll over. So it was kind of a buy the rumor, sell the news event. And so cannabis really has had a year and a half to adjust. And so we really went through our pain with the public market and then the corresponding private market pullback after. There's always a lag where you know, privates don't pull back immediately like a public would, but eventually they do. And so we saw that. And so when the rest of the market really took a hit in mid-March, it wasn't quite as bad for cannabis because we had already been off, you know, maybe 50 to 75% in certain names. So this recent sell-off, we haven't really seen more contraction in multiples. I think it's too early to see that. But what we have seen in both public and private markets is a lack of capital. So whether you're a public or a private, you generally need money. Because it's a capital intensive industry and the capital markets generally aren't open right now. So the best operators will get money, but 80 to 90% of them won't. And so, you know, that's similar, I think, in both markets. And what I've been encouraging a lot of our investees to adopt is a survive then thrive mentality. You know, we first got to get through COVID and all the, depending on the markets you're in, the different challenges, whether it be regulatory or overtaxation or proliferation of the black market. You know, we need to get through all these challenges. And if you're still standing in 6 or 12 or 18 months, then you have exponentially better chance of being one of those long-term winners, being one of those Budweisers at the end of the day. So, you know, whether our companies are in the public or the private space, we're telling them the same thing, you know, like get your costs down. We're in uncertain times. Make sure you navigate these choppy waters and come out on the other side of it with a chance to gain market share and be a longer term winner.
So Tyler, one thing that you'd mentioned was the access to capital being an issue both in public and private markets. As kind of an effect of that, have you seen your investment horizon in terms of your portfolio companies, have you seen that increase where, you know, in a company that perhaps you'd be looking to IPO or sell to a strategic acquirer in 3 years, perhaps that's maybe being moved out to 5 years or longer? Or are you seeing any effects in that?
Absolutely. Yeah, I would say, you know, we were lucky with our timing on the first fund, having launched that in early 17, in January of 17. We were making investments by March of 17, and we had already had some exits within a year. So spring, summer 18, we had already had 2 exits out of the first fund. And that was because we had really robust public markets and some of our ancillary businesses were getting sold into these LPs. And so as soon as the market started cooling in late 18, that natural exit strategy for us changed a lot. So LPs weren't throwing silly money around on M&A because they couldn't access the markets to the same extent. And furthermore, there was a few that made some really bad deals at the top of the market. And so I think everyone just kind of got scared overpaying for assets. So, you know, that's definitely affected our exit on certain privates. You know, we've had multiple Fund 1 and Fund 2 companies that were in late stage discussions on exits. And given the markets just pulled back, those deals never happened. And they're essentially off the table right now. So, you know, we were also lucky that we still have a lot of life left on both funds. They're both set up as 5 to 10 year funds, so we can take these things out to 10 years if we still have positions that need time. So, you know, we're not coming due on those until 2028, 2029. So, you know, we've got a lot of time, thankfully, with these companies to get exits.
What I find fascinating is the dichotomy between the current market environment, which is pretty poor in terms of capital raising, basically have seen very, very little in terms of equity financing, aside from the odd distressed deal. You contrast that to a couple of years ago, a peak of the market, where a ton of deals were getting done for seemingly pretty much every cannabis company. You had investment banks or underwriting 9-figure deals. You had strategic investors, whether they be alcohol or tobacco companies, underwriting multi-billion-dollar equity investments at what seemed like very, very high valuations. What do you think ultimately happened? Did they pay too far or too high of a price, and are things cheap now, or how, like, what do you think happened since a couple of years ago? I remember specifically you were quite bearish on the licensed producers back at the peak of the market, and that turned out to be, you know, an absolutely great call. I'm just wondering what you saw then and if things have changed now, given prices have come down pretty significantly and there could be some distressed opportunities.
Yeah, no, that's very accurate. You know, I think there was a lot of FOMO with investors in the market. You know, like the real returns, I think, were made in 2015, 2016, 2017, and then I think the rest of the public kind of got onto that story and started taking these stocks higher in the last leg. And it was also fueled by these large liquor companies or tobacco companies, Altria coming in and Constellation coming in and, you know, taking the equity prices even higher. And then the retail investor didn't want to miss out on that ride. And, you know, I always use like the cab driver or the Uber driver example. Like, you know, when your cabbie or your Uber driver is talking about pot stocks,
yeah,
you probably should be selling, right?
It's the it's the shoe shine boy story
too, right?
Sorry, go ahead.
What's that?
I said it's the shoe shine boy story. In 1929, that's when you know when to get out of stocks, when your shoe shine boy is talking about how much money they're making. But as you indicated, cab drivers, Uber drivers as well, they're kind of, after they've gotten involved, there's really no one else to bid up the stocks, right?
That's right. Yeah. So, you know, we could see it. We could see it was coming. But the problem is, you know, you could see it coming for what felt like years, you know. And so every time you'd sell, you were wrong because the market just went higher and higher and higher for years, until, of course, it didn't. So, yeah, too much money, I think, chasing the same stocks and, you know, like a lot of bad actors, too, you know, whether they were investors or whether they were brokers, bankers, or entrepreneurs starting these companies. You know, a lot of these companies had no right being public. You know, it was a pure promotion game. And we're seeing the downside of that now with certain stocks off 90-95% from their highs. You know, the other thing that I think we convinced ourselves of here in Canada was that we were going to be the dominant global player in cannabis because we were next to Uruguay, the first country to really roll out a proper recreational program. And so our large public companies had access to capital and they were going to take that capital all around the globe and use our expertise to build out industries everywhere, whether it be Europe or South America or Africa or Asia. And that never really happened. You know, we didn't really get to a point where we made a dent in the global market. And, you know, all these other countries are turning on their own industries and looking locally for people to grow those. So I think, you know, that was probably, maybe a little bit misleading that we were going to capture most of the global market. And so I think that's why that was the only way you could really explain the valuations at the peak is to say, okay, well, this is going to be a $200 billion global industry and Canada is going to capture a lot of it, right?
Yeah, what I find really interesting is you rewind back to the Eddie bull market days when you had basically dead mining shells who couldn't raise any assets. They changed their name to cannabis. The stock would go up fivefold, and next thing you know, there's a $10 million bought deal term sheet in front of them, and off to the races, and they can pay themselves again. But we all know how that kind of turned out. Most of them have kind of gotten back to the spent all the money and now a shell once again. So what do you think is going to happen to all these kind of smaller cannabis producers that lack the perhaps professionalism, the assets and the brand to be successful, but mostly that lack capital? You know, say investors are stuck in one of these smaller names. What are they to do here? And what do you think is going to happen?
Yeah, I don't think there's an easy way out of it. Unfortunately, I think we're going to see more bankruptcy filings. And, you know, we're already seeing some of our publicly traded LPs go into creditor protection. And I think this is going to be an ongoing theme for the next couple of years until this is really cleaned out. And then I think some of the mining shells that these guys used, I think we're, you know, going to have some cannabis shells to use. Now, I don't know if there'll be any money in there for them to have any value, but, you know, I remember when we were pitching our fund 3-4 years ago, you know, my prediction at the time was we were going to have 250 LPs and then it would need to be whittled down to 25 because I thought, okay, well, how many large brewers or large tobacco companies are there. There's not that many, really. You know, we consolidate the industry and pick some winners to aggregate it. And, you know, I think we ended up getting more like 300 LPs. And I still think we're probably down to 25 large companies that can grow at scale and grow well and provide cannabis as an ingredient, say, if it's not just dried flower, it's a vape pen or an edible or a concentrator, topical or something like that. And then you probably have hundreds of what we'll call the micro growers or the micro producers, which will play into that craft theme. And those companies probably don't need to be public. And it'll be the larger public LPs that need to buy these smaller micros, just the way the beer and wine industry consolidates, because the larger groups tend not to be able to produce the same quality. And so it's the smaller, more nimble growers that will have stronger genetics and more exotic genetics, and they'll have better grow techniques from their three decades of growing. And they'll be putting the interesting products out there on the market, and the large guys will be snapping them up to lock up those products. I think that's how it's going to roll out.
There's a lot of scenarios that could play out in terms of the development of the industry. I'm interested to hear how you think the cannabis industry will look like 10 years from now. Is it going to be similar to tobacco, where it's highly consolidated with kind of, you know, two or three really dominant players? Or is it going to look more like the alcohol industry, where you have a ton of different sort of small, crappy craft producers that are eating the large producers' lunches?
Yeah, I think the latter. You know, I think it'll be a barbelled industry, more like alcohol, where you've got a few large ones and a lot of smaller, crafty guys. And you're going to have different brands and different companies for all the different products that are out there. So people are calling we're in cannabis 2.0 right now. 1.0 would have been when we launched in October of 2018, and all we had really was dried flower and some tinctures and gel caps. And now we've got all the edibles, we've got the vape pens and the other forms of concentrate. So when you start breaking the market up, all the cannabis products, into 8 or 10 different categories, I think you've got multiple brands and companies that are going to have IP or expertise playing in different categories. Just like, you know, if we take beverages or something, you know, you've got beer companies, you've got wine companies, you've got spirit, you've got this new ready to drink segment that's showing a lot of growth. So I think cannabis will be similar. You know, you'll have different companies playing in different areas and doing different things really good. And I think that's what's going to take the stigma away from cannabis. You know, once we have these products that look more normal on the shelves, I think that social consumption is going to be really important. You know, I know I'm leaning on alcohol a lot here, but I think there's a lot of analogies to use. Like we know how acceptable it is to sit in a public setting, whether it be a bar, lounge, a restaurant, and drink alcohol, and in a lot of cases drink too much alcohol. And right now, cannabis is a little bit more secretive. And I think the 2.0 products help bring it out of the dark and bring it out of the alley, so to speak, and put it, make it more normalized. And so whether that's in the form of a beverage or in the form of food, something where you can sit and enjoy watching the Flames game while you're having a craft THC infused beer on tap. You know, so I think in 10 years, that'll be the norm. We'll be used to that. We'll be able to go into a restaurant or a pub, say, and have a cannabis beer that's got 3 or 5 milligrams of THC. And maybe we can even have 2 or 3 and be fairly coherent and be able to walk home after, you know. I think that's the future, and then that's how it becomes normalized. And I just think beverages is a good way to do it, because we're so accustomed to celebrating and socializing with beverages.
Yeah, cannabis-infused beverages certainly have received a lot of hype, and there's a lot of high expectations behind this market segment. I've read some mixed reviews. I've heard there's some difficulty kind of mixing in the oil into a drinkable format. I haven't tasted it myself. What are your thoughts on these drinks? Are they there yet in terms of quality? And if not, do you think they will get there and crack this market such that it can, you know, expand to these lofty expectations?
Yeah, it's a good question. I don't think they're there yet. You know, the technology is improving. There's a lot of different technologies, mostly nano emulsification right now, which, you know, helps with the water solubility of the THC so that it gets mixed in properly so you can dose properly. You know, the other part of it is onset and duration. I think a lot of us have had bad experiences with edibles, or you've heard of someone that's had a bad experience with an edible because you eat it or you drink it and you don't feel anything. So you double down on it. And next thing you know, the first one's coming in just while the second one starts kicking in and you've done too much and you're in bad spot. But, you know, that technology is getting better so that you can get a quicker onset. So a lot of these can hit you in 20 to 30 minutes, which is becoming very close to what a beer or glass of wine might hit you in. And then the duration of it is a lot shorter. You're not committed to this for 4 to 6 hours, but maybe 1 or 2 hours. And so I think that's really important. You know, I think a lot of the drinks or the beverages that hit the market initially, and I'm thinking more in the U.S. because they've had a head start on us, there was some sort of a sugary concoction that, you know, resembled more of like an energy drink. And it wasn't, to me, that's not really how you gain consumers. You put it in a format that they already like and that they're already comfortable with. So whether that's like a sparkling water or some sort of like soda or a beer, you know, much better than some hibiscus, lime, sugar drink. So I think the social consumption as well is big for beverages, because I think right now cannabis it's not very social because people don't want to stand around in public and consume cannabis, and you're not really allowed to. So I think the having these beverages in a public setting is also going to be really important to penetrating the market. And now most of these large alcohol companies or beverage companies like a Coke or a Pepsi, even, they've come out with a view on cannabis, and in a lot of cases they've made investments. So they believe it's real. I think they're seeing their market decline, particularly the beer segment, and they're seeing cannabis and cannabis beverages as a disruption to that. And so they want to be partnered with the right groups to get into those markets. So I think we're still early on beverages, but I'm long-term bullish on them.
Well, there we go. We have our answer here and a ton of great insights. So thanks, Tyler. Before we wrap this podcast up, just wanted to give you a chance to let listeners know where they can learn more about you, whether it be your website, social media, things of that nature.
Yeah, I think the website is probably best. So that's greenacrecapital.ca. So a lot of information on the team as well as some of the investments we've made. I'll admit we're not as strong on social. So I think the website's probably the better place to go.
All right. Well, thanks so much, Tyler. You guys can check them out at greenacrecapital.ca if you'd like to learn more. But for now, I want to thank you for spending time with us on the Absolute Return podcast, and we'll chat with you soon. Cheers.
Thanks for tuning in to the Absolute Return podcast. This episode was brought to you by Accelerate Financial Technologies. Accelerate, because performance matters. Find out more at accelerateshares.com. The views expressed in this podcast are the personal views of the participants and do not reflect the views of Accelerate. No aspect of this podcast constitutes investment, legal, or tax advice. Opinions expressed in this podcast should not be viewed as a recommendation or solicitation of an offer to buy or sell any securities or investment strategies. The information and opinions in this podcast forecasts are based on current market conditions and may fluctuate and change in the future. No representation or warranty, expressed or implied, is made on behalf of Accelerate as to the accuracy or completeness of the information contained in this podcast. Accelerate does not accept any liability for any direct, indirect, or consequential loss or damage suffered by any person as a result of relying on all or any part of this podcast, and any liability is expressly disclaimed.